wpfw.org. Again, that's wpfw.org.
Yo, peace, this is Rod Stars.
Peace, this is G1, and together we're Rebel Diaz. When we in the DMV, you know we listening to that People Power Radio, WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice. Let's go.
Escuchando in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. El Distrito Colombia here on this Friday, April 18th, 2025. We're also here on latinomediacollective.com. You can also find us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we blur the lines between politics and fashion as we spend the hour discussing the political history of Latinos wearing black and how the aesthetics manifest itself politically in a variety of ways, mostly from a working class point of view. And in order to have this conversation, we're spending the hour with Edward Salazar Celis, who's a writer, cultural critic, and educator specializing in Latinx American art, fashion, and visual cultures. He wrote an article in November of last year in Harvard's Revista magazine entitled "Black is a Working Class Color: The Latinx Politics of Wearing Black." He joins us on the show for the first time today. Welcome to the show, Edward Salazar Celis.
Thank you, Oscar. It's a pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. And this is going to be quite an interesting story because in your article, you state at the beginning that wearing black, generally speaking, can range from the ubiquitous and anonymous to even elegant and sometimes opulent.
Right.
With that said, you also state the following in your article, and I think this is probably the best way to begin this conversation. You say, quote, "To propose an alternative approach to black that unsettles or at least challenges the elite associations with wearing black, I'd like to expand," I meaning you in this context, "the cultural meanings of black clothing by centering Latinx, migrants, working class people, and racialized bodies in terms of ongoing migration and Latinx lives in the United States," end quote. I think this is a good way to start the conversation here. So could you expand on this argument and how it perhaps ties to recent events, if at all possible.
Right. This is a good start, like starting by the end of the piece. It's very enticing. And actually, it starts, at least from my perspective, as a genuine curiosity in regards to how black is widely perceived as a symbol of elegance, modernity, global cities, and fashion, high fashion more broadly. So I was curious about what else, how can I add different layer to the history of the color, centering those outside like the historical dominances within fashion history. So for me, it was like a way to think about the role of working class, migrants, Latinx individuals in the production of aesthetics beyond like dominant histories. That being said, of course, that it is true that wearing black is highly connected with certain high-class performances, certain spaces of power, especially in the case of artistic circles, designed environments. And there is a long history that connects wearing black from Coco Chanel in Europe, especially in France, to like an ongoing series of fashion designers interested in black. That, for example, the history of the little black dress as the epitome of elegance and modernity emerged. So I was wondering how I can expand that history that it for me is very true, very interesting indeed, but still hegemonic, and a history that produces some silences in regards how working class people manage both to survive and to create amidst difficult conditions. And actually remembering that even for Chanel, where she was inspired in her designs by working class people wearing black. She observed conspicuously people working in stores, in the public space in general, wearing that color. So for me, there is a highly evident relationship between wearing black and working class people outside that associations with the elites.
Fantastic. And like I said before we even started recording here, that a lot of what we'll be discussing with regards to the interpretation of wearing black has oftentimes been unspoken and unwritten and even unconscious as well.
Absolutely.
But perhaps one early example in your article that bears worth mentioning is you citing Salvadoran writer Javier Zamora's memoir book, Solito, as one of the main inspirations, among others. Can you tell us about the importance of wearing black from the point of view of migrants who wore it as, quote, a coat of armor, as how Javier Zamora put it in his memoir book? Because I have to say, as a Salvadoran, he's somebody who's high on my list as far as people that I would like to talk to with regards to not only his experiences, but also this, again, unspoken, unwritten, unconscious aesthetic of, in this case, using black, wearing black clothes, as a, quote, coat of armor here.
Right. Yes. So I first read Javier Zamora's book out of curiosity and genuine interest in his history and how he can convey a sense of poetics within the political history of migration, especially in his exercise of recovering his memories as an accompanying minor traveling to the U.S. to meet his parents. So I wasn't like expecting finding that much amount of black clothing in my reading. It emerged throughout the book. So then I was fascinated by the attentiveness of Zamora's about clothing in general, but more specifically about wearing dark pieces throughout the entire book. And I started to count how many times black clothing or that clothes appears in the book. And it was so much that I stopped doing that exercise because I didn't want to like quantify it. But instead of that, ask why he is so attentive to clothing throughout the history, right? And the first element was his own memory of his family wearing black, for example, to go into church, to go into the school for certain occasions that that requires some elegance and decency, let's say that, right? But also black clothing was unavoidable and actually a mandate for self-protection and collective protection in his journey from El Salvador throughout Central America upward until the border with Mexico, US-Mexico border, right? So there is a lot of presence of black clothing, starting with his backpack. And in the novel, he remembered his Ninja Turtles backpack that was like his object of joy, of personal identification, his like something very, very personal to his affects. And he had to, instead of that, travel with a black backpack as a means to protect his body, right? And to like somehow produce individual but also collective camouflage amidst the hardships of migration, right? So for me, black clothing was both a site for high identity to convey a sense of invisibility and protection, but also at the same time, wearing black was a mean to create a collective sense of care for the other, right? Because he, Javier Zamora tells that he was a minor, and therefore he was protected by other adults who migrated with him that also used black, wore black clothing to be safe. So in the book, he constantly remembers us that was Don Dago, the coyote in the story, who demand that, like wearing dark clothes all the time. And therefore, Javier Zamora remembers his dark blue jeans, his dark t-shirt, his belt that was also black, his black shoes, and so on and so forth. So, and the other, like, more poetic element is how wearing black is also a way to camouflage with the night and with the landscape. So there are a lot of layers of nuances in that beautiful history that I really, really commend to read.
Yeah, that's why I would love to have Zamora here on the show one of these days, because that is a tricky thing that he did in his book. This back and forth of both humanizing and dehumanizing,
right,
the concept and the idea of wearing black in this instance as a migrant trying to enter the country, because Zamora, the individual, is trying to humanize it, but the coyotes in his book are dehumanizing it. And that's a unique back and forth that is not easy to do,
right,
in a book, let alone a memoir. And that sort of brings me up to another book that may have played a role in your inspiration in writing this article. And that's from Jean Baudrillard. Let me know if I'm saying the name correctly. And his book, The System of Objects. Can you expand on this as well? Because this may be more to the dehumanizing side of both what Zamora was doing in his book and also what you're doing in your article as well, and how wearing black can go both ways here.
Yeah, Jean Baudrillard is a very like famous and established scholar. Like, is part of the canon in regards to the studies of material culture, objects, and the production of meaning through our material culture, right? So in The System of Objects, he wants to like underscore what is the importance and the centrality of objects in human life, and how humans relates to objects and how objects gain meaning through all certain relationships in the context of capitalistic production and the commodification of life, right? As part of his observations, Baudrillard describes the color black as opposed to nature. Black is the other thing that is not instinctual to life, right? So for him, black, white, gray, or whatever registers zero on the color scale is a paradigm of modernity, dignity, repression, moral standing. And therefore, he reminds us that black color is very tied to control, self-control of the body. And it's a means to like convey and achieve certain social expectations about piety, decency, and social presentation more broadly. So I was trying to, I used Baudrillard in my text to acknowledge his contribution, of course, but also to challenge this idea that a color is only tied to a history of the elites, right? So my question to Baudrillard was, okay, but what else? What happened when I interrogate a color outside traditional French haute couture or objects produced by the elites, right? And what other senses emerge from that questioning? And in this case of a color, that a color could be seen as a very neutral or non-political thing, but quite the contrary.
So with regards to the politics of wearing black, for Latinos born in the United States, one of the earliest and perhaps best examples, in my opinion, of the aesthetic were the pachucos who wore zoot suits back in the 1930s. Now, although you concede that fashion does not replace direct political action, can you tell us how the pachuco aesthetic best exemplifies what Catherine Ramirez describes as style politics? Because I do agree with you that fashion does not always replace direct political action. But I've told people in a variety of ways in the last few shows here that whether we're talking about LGBTQ people or Latinos or people of Arab or Muslim descent, sometimes your very existence, sometimes your very identity can be political. And I bring that up because I think that also lends itself to the concept of style politics that Catherine Ramirez describes. But please.
Yes, sure. First, I have the honor and the privilege that Catherine Ramirez is my advisor in my PhD training.
Oh, really?
Yes. So I have a close relationship with her, and I deeply admire what she did in that book. This is The Woman in the Suit Suit, where she studied the politics of style in the specific case of pachucas within the larger history of Mexican Americans and the Chicano movement that emerged around the 60s and was very solid during the 70s and right, and so on and so forth. So she was trying to challenge that very masculinistic history of Chicanos, Chicanas, pachucos, or pachucas in the US by centering the figure of the pachuca, the female counterpart of the pachuco, that it's not only but mostly defined by wearing a suit suit. And a suit suit is a very interesting piece that looks like a working suit suit for the office, right? That was first done by African Americans in the 30s, especially in Harlem in New York, as a piece very tied to cultural scenarios such as jazz clubs, jazz music in general, and artistic endeavors. But the suit suit like expanded throughout the entire United States, and it was also worn by Asian Americans, particularly people from Filipino descent, and Mexican Americans very conspicuously in California and in the Southwest. The suit suit is the reinterpretation of a traditional suit that exaggerates the proportions, that therefore uses more material, and therefore created a very suspicious outfit that was against like white normativity and the like more assimilationist style produced by Western fashion, right? So the suit suit departed for a very masculine attire, but at the same time it changes it towards something more flamboyant, let's say. And that's why actually Catherine Ramirez argues that the pachuco culture is in itself queer, because they are always queering the original, quote unquote, original object, right? But one interesting difference between the African American, the suit suit and the suit suit used conspicuously by the pachucos was that the pachucos prefer wearing black suit, darker suit suits. It's not that all pachucos only use black clothing, but it was something that caught my attention, right? That specific detail. And Dr. Catherine Ramirez also in her book argues that it was not only about the suit suit that was dark. It was also the makeup that pachucas decided to adopt. And like in this exercise where makeup affirms certain femininity, but at the same time challenges both the larger U.S. assumptions of femininity, but also the Mexican and Mexican American assumptions of decency and for women, right? So this dark, heavy makeup in the eyes, in the lips, with this pompadour hairstyles that were so super high, also challenges both the masculinistic history of pachucos, the cultural expectations of Mexicanidad and Mexican-Americanness, right? While also challenging femininity at large. Even they were like read as lesbians, as not heterosexuals, right? Because their look was highly suspicious of something. And actually, amongst the reasons why the suit was super popular and super meaningful in war times, but also in post-war times, was because it conveyed a sense of unity and of national pride, of difference, and with belonging without assimilation, right? And to the point that the outfit was highly criminalized, and it ended infamously suit suit riots in LA in 1943. That were previously informed by the Sleepy Lagoon incidents in 1942. So there is a history of violence, but also a history of pride in behind the suit.
You know, I don't know if it was you or Catherine Ramirez in the article who made this argument in addition to what you just said, but when it comes to the aesthetic of wearing black, especially how it was interpreted by pachucos during the suit time period, there's also a lot of timelessness to it, that it has stood the test of time. I saw that picture in your article, the black and white picture of the Zoot Suiters in your article from the 1930s. And even though it's from the 1930s, I look at that picture, and not only do I see people that kind of look like my relatives, but I also see people there in that picture where if you would see them walking on the street today, they would not look entirely out of place. And that sort of lends itself to the timeless nature of that particular aesthetic. And you just mentioned that there was a lot of unity and national pride in wearing those suits during that time period. And that's probably why many Chicanos, especially in that part of the United States over the West Coast, still draw a lot of inspiration and influence from that aesthetic almost 100 years later.
Yes. So first, the suit is highly alive, and that's something very important to acknowledge. For me, it's fundamental in my work, not only trying to reconstruct the past, but show how the past informs the present and how the present and the past build the future, the Latinx futurity, and how fashion can contribute to that. So that's an important thing to acknowledge. And you can see like reverberations of the suit throughout artistic practices, everyday sartorial choices, and there is an ongoing interest in reclaiming and reinterpreting those aesthetics. And a specific example of that is Chicano designer Willy Chavarria, that is very popular these days because he was part of Paris Fashion Week this year. Last year, he won the CFDA award as the menswear designer of the year. He also won the award, the Latin American Fashion Award, as the Latin American, like Latinx Latin American designer of the year. So he's having a moment because of his ability and his sensibility of like taking Latinx, but more specifically, Chicano, Chicana, Cholo, Chola aesthetics, informing his own design. So there is an element of present and futurity in the suit. The other photo I think you are mentioning is that from downtown Los Angeles in 1943. And that photo describes a different style that was more a youth, playful style, cool, that actually anticipated the Rebel Without a Cause style that came after the 40s, especially in the 60s and the 70s. So, for example, Anthony Macias argues that even the cool style was originating within Mexican-American communities. And the cool style is basically wearing blue jeans, certain sneakers, Dr. Martin inspired shoes with these big jackets, very college style. Right. So in that part of my argument, I am trying to frame how the contributions of Mexican Americans, specifically and more broadly Latinx populations in the US, still informs fashion politics and fashion creativity until the present. So yeah, those young people in that photo can be easily seen today in whatever Washington or San Jose and be super, super in vogue.
Absolutely. It's a timeless look, you know, Absolutely. Black jacket, blue jeans. But when you put it in the context of pachucos, as in that picture in your article, then not only does it carry a lot more meaning, but it carries a lot more influence and a lot more inspiration almost 100 years later.
Absolutely.
So we're going to take a break right here. We're speaking with Edward Salazar, who's a writer, cultural critic, and educator specializing in Latinx American arts, fashion, and visual cultures. His recent article in Harvard's Revista is entitled Black is a Working Class Color, the Latinx Politics of Wearing Black. This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned. Is singing La Camisa Negra, the black shirt, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone, you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we're speaking about the politics of wearing black with Edward Salazar, who's a writer, cultural critic, and educator specializing in Latinx American arts, fashion, and visual cultures. His recent article in Harvard's Revista is entitled Black is a Working Class Color, the Latinx Politics of Wearing Black. So I want to draw your attention now to the style politics combining with direct political action, as we mentioned in the first half of the show, because you cite both the Brown Berets of the 1960s and the 1970s. I would personally argue that I think the Young Lords in the East Coast should also be included to a certain degree, but I wonder if you could expand on how this time period exemplifies how wearing black became a facade for resistance during this time. Much like what we mentioned with the Pachucos in the 1930s and 40s, there was a harsh political climate against people of Latino descent. Same so in the 60s and 70s, but it manifests itself in a different way.
You are super right, and I do agree that I should include the Young Lords as part of my argumentation. And the sole reason I didn't do it is because I was out of space first. And the other reason is because I am still reading Joana Fernandez's book, The Young Lords,
yes.
Radical History. And this is a super, super big and important book, so I wanted to chew in on them with a lot of detailing and care. So I didn't manage to include that example that is very, very connected to the history of the Chicano movement more broadly and more specifically to the case of the Brown Berets.
Yeah, I had the pleasure of speaking with Joana Fernandez several years ago. So that is a book worth reading, but please continue.
Yeah, she's fantastic. So the Black Berets emerged within the context of the Chicano civil rights movements in 1967 as a very organized, political, radical somehow movement reclaiming for workers' rights against violence stemming from different actors within the U.S. society. And they use very, very consciously certain style politics to draw on that concept that took inspiration from the Black Panther Party across the U.S. and especially in California, right? So specific elements such as the beret was central to their style, and the beret was brown because it conveys a sense of racial pride, ethnic and racial pride, where the brown color mimics or evokes brown skin and how a certain politics of beyond the white black binary can emerge, right? So it's a very semiotic use of the color, and the beret is a very like telling and political element throughout the Americas and actually globally, and how the beret is connected with a lot of rebellious and dissident movements, as such as actually the Young Lords that actually use that piece very, very significantly. But also within the Brown Berets, that it was a very short movement in its existence. It only lasted about 5 years, I think, 5 to 6 years, more or less, in Los Angeles, is that the movement also had a very visible conflict and overlook of the feminine, of the women's presence within the collective, yeah, right? Because those movements are not outside like of patriarchy and the reproduction of certain masculinistic views of political participation. So in that context, the female counterpart within the Brown Berets decided to challenge like very conservative views that deemed their uniform as too sexy, as showing too much skin. And against that, they decided to use black short skirt, miniskirt, black shoes, especially black huaraches, as the Pachucas did before, or black slacks, so on and so forth. And they decided to keep their hair black and long, resembling and honoring their indigenous heritage, because there is a very symbolic but also material and visible relationship between having long hair and indigeneity. So, and especially preserving and keeping that black hair as part of the performance. the Brown Berets movement, although they draw fashion on dress practices to convey a political message, were not as much as interested in fashion as, for example, the Pachucos were before that.
This is an interesting observation, because the last time I did a show like this where fashion and politics meet, it was several years ago with regards to the Cholita aesthetic in Bolivia.
In Bolivia.
And the indigenous women there made a very direct and purposeful decision to maintain their long hair as a means to maintain their indigeneity, as you said it. And that's a good way to understand, at least at a global level, you know, the intent of Chicana women during that time period as well. And much like the Pachucos that we mentioned in the first half of the show, you look at old pictures of the Brown Berets from the 60s and 70s, there is a timeless nature as well.
Absolutely. Where,
much like the Pachucos, you could see any of them walking down the street today and they would not be out of place at all. And again, that lends itself, I think, to the inspiration that people draw from that time period, especially when it comes to politics as well. Now, this is curious now. I'm curious to get your thoughts on Columbia singer Juanes and his 2005 song, La Camisa Negra. We played that during the break on the show here, and it was everywhere during that time period and still remains a popular song for a variety of reasons. Does the otherwise unspoken and unconscious political aspects of wearing black, especially as we discussed it during the course of this conversation, perhaps lends itself to the song's popularity? I know it wasn't in your article, but I'm still curious to get your thoughts on this song.
Sure. So I actually was born in Colombia, so the song was very present throughout my life. And because Juanes is highly popular throughout Latin America and the U.S., and that song especially hits the marks in many, many countries, right? So I wasn't connected that, but it's a very interesting connection from your side. My thoughts on that would be that I think the shirt, the camisa negra, is a very working class tropos in general. It's a very practical piece. And one of the advantages of a white or a monocolor piece is that you can use that as to convey different messages, right? And if you remember, Juanes used that shirt to say, se habla español. So it was a stance connected with some pride, like cultural pride, that translated very well into the Latinx communities in the U.S. So you can draw a lot of connections. I have to do a second paper, I guess, on this topic, but yeah.
That's a good point right there towards the end. And maybe it draws more inspiration by Latinos in the U.S. and probably elsewhere because of what we've discussed thus far in this conversation. Now, in every scenario that we have mentioned thus far, women have always played a role in the politics of wearing black. But I have to say, in my opinion, as a 90s kid, women were front and center in the 90s more than any other time period that we cited when it comes to the politics of wearing black. In fact, you mentioned the 1994 film Mi Vida Loca as an example of Chola Latina teenagers in Los Angeles. So I give you credit for that automatically right there. And you also mentioned the Instagram post of Veteranas en Rucas. Right. And I had the pleasure several years ago of interviewing Guadalupe Rosales, you know, about that Instagram post. It's still around. It's a fantastic Instagram post. I encourage everyone to check it out to learn more about that aesthetic in the 90s. So for this period in the 90s, you argued that the 90s created a, quote, a look meant to produce fear rather than productive availability and exploitable bodies. And I think to a large degree, that's exemplified in the film Mi Vida Loca. I wonder if you could expand on this argument.
Yes, cholos y cholas from the 90s adopted a style that clashes with the ideals of white appearance and assimilation, preferring to provoke fear, as you mentioned, rather than present themselves as available labor, although they were, of course, working class individuals in serving positions throughout the country, right? as such, Scholl style is one response to a dominant culture that racialized not only their labor, but also their bodies, or there is a very deep entanglement between the racialization of the body and racialization of labor and criminalization. Although there is a lot of research and evidence in regards the participation of Cholos and Cholas and many communities in gang activity, not all Cholos and Cholas participated into gang activity. Still, the look in itself, the visual features of that aesthetics was highly popular amongst Latinx individuals, regardless of their personal decisions. More precisely, the Cholo style in the 90s was primarily achieved throughout the stylization of working class, working clothes in oversized silhouettes, often featuring jeans or khaki colored pants worn high up in the waist with black belt, plain white shirts layered with another shirt, and pristine white sneakers. Logos were generally avoided, with some exceptions, such as the case of Nike. And also tattoos were also essential, serving as both a stylistic element and a form of resistance to social expectations. And there is actually a very interesting discussion about how indigenous tattooing practices have informed Pachuco and Pachuca Chola Cholo tattooing practices. I cannot dive into that because I'm still learning about that. But there is also another layer of nuance and cultural history there. And coming back again to the specific case of Cholos and Cholas, they adapted their working class clothing and refashioned that to create a new and very original sense of style, departing for practical and less expensive pieces. And additionally, Cholos opted frequently for practicality, durability, and affordability that also connects with their decision in the case of men, of shaving their heads because it was cheaper, right?
Yeah.
So there is a very interesting shifting of precarity towards creativity and creative labor that is very, very interesting, and that also challenges this idea that how working class people present themselves, and also how the clothing intended to work serves to like more creative purposes. In the case of women, I think that Guadalupe Rosales's beautiful project, Veteranas and Rucas, that Instagram project, that digital humanities project, is not about fashion. But fashion is everywhere there, right? You can see the patterns and the continuities in those looks. So when you observe that those photographies, you observe a lot of women wearing black clothing, whether in shirts, t-shirts, slacks, makeup, a combination between pompadours and more lower hairstyles. For me, it was super self-evident that there is something happening there around wearing black clothing. And there is a connection between working class aesthetics, clothing that is used in a very sometimes oppressive, a very underpaying environment, and the production of a style. Actually, one of the strengths and at the same time, weakness of the Mi Vida Loca film, My Crazy Life, is that the film heavily relies on aesthetics to create an atmosphere and to recreate a historical period. And in doing so, the movie portrayed Cholas, homegirls, very vividly. And it creates kind of a historical document about their style. But at the same time, it flattened a little bit the history of Cholos and Cholas and their social conflicts, their clashes and reclamations of territory, belonging, as only a matter of style. So this is something very interesting in regards to Thai politics is how you have to be super careful in tracing the line between thinking that fashion does all the political labor and thinking when fashion limits or is only apparent in that problem. So that is like the tricky and the actually the exciting element in like analyzing those visualities. But also at the same time, the visual is political. You cannot divide those decisions, because those decisions, when you if you see the photo in my article, in there is something rebellious and challenging against like norms of femininity and decency that those women are frankly and directly contesting.
Yeah, the nuances of that film is a one-hour conversation in and of itself. And I just want to say once again that we love Guadalupe Rosales. We encourage everyone to check out her Instagram post, Veteranas en Rucas,
and
to
learn more about the history. It's fantastic, indeed.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. It's timeless like everything else we mentioned. Yes. So now let's fast forward to recent times to San Jose, California, because this plays a very crucial and important part in understanding the aesthetics of wearing black in recent times. And we're kind of going to do the same thing that Javier Zamora did, which is go back and forth with regards to humanizing and dehumanizing here, because we've done a lot of humanizing with regards to the aesthetics of wearing black by Latinos. But towards the end of your article, there's a component here that shows that wearing black can be very dehumanizing, especially for the working class, especially for workers who do not have the control of their circumstances, especially recent migrants. So I wonder if you could explain this component towards the end of your article and how it lends itself to understanding how it's being used in recent times. And again, it's not easy to go back and forth with regards to humanizing and dehumanizing the politics of wearing black here. But I think towards the end of your article, this is a good example of both.
Yes, absolutely. Similarly, with my experience with Javier Zamora's book, I wasn't at first like trying to see people wearing black. It was kind of an accident, but that's part of the ethnographic work, right? You are not always anticipating what you will encounter, but it's very, again, self-evident throughout careful observation that workers in server positions, in cleaning the premises, taking care of the windows, so on and so forth, always wear black clothing. So there is, again, something happening there. And then I found that flyer for a server orientation company, right? Asking its future employees, whatever, wearing black. Black shoes, black socks, black shirt, black pants, and right? This idea of the uniform conveys a double sense of invisibility and availability. It's invisibility because it allows the worker to camouflage with the environment and being only an element for exploitation and production. And that's the part of visibility, invisibility, but also an element that conveys availability, because it's something that is available always to serve, to do something, to work for others. And I mean, working in itself is not a problem. Working is a very human activity. But the problem here is how, for me, the uniform or the act of wearing black reveals certain politics for working class Latinx and recent migrants. And the other element that caught my attention is that I did those ethnographic observations in a very high-end mall in San Jose, California. And it's interesting that because a fashion in general and those spaces for consumption prefer black decoration, so black walls, black countertops, black elements in general to produce a sense of elegance. So I was like arguing in the article that it's interesting how those workers wearing black camouflages with the aesthetic landscape of the mall. So they were, in that sense, wearing black clothing is not a mean of showing your personality or your individuality, yeah, but rather disappear within the landscape of labor.
Yeah, that's a powerful thing to mention there towards the end. Now, usually towards the end of the show, I'll ask the guests, what else do you hope people learn from this article? What else do you hope people draw from this article? But considering the observation that you had with this company, that's called The Company, as you said, the next time somebody goes to a shopping mall, those who have been listening to this conversation here on the radio, the next time they go to the shopping mall, what do you hope at the very least people look at or look for when it comes to the aesthetics of wearing black here? Because we've done a lot to try to humanize the aesthetics and its historical meaning within Latinos here in the United States. And while the object here for this company that you mentioned was to dehumanize workers, that doesn't necessarily mean you or I or the audience should look at it through the same lens of dehumanization. So again, what do you hope people see the next time they go to their mall or go to any store and they see somebody wearing black? What do you hope that they observe now that they have this understanding through an article like yours?
Yes, maybe at least two things. First is how fashion has this beautiful side of being creative, creation, even very hard conditions, and how beauty and resistance can emerge despite like the conditions. So it was interesting for me observing how those workers always personalize their uniforms with small details, the nails, a different size in the wide of their pants, disobeying with certain sneakers instead of others, personalizing their hairstyle, their glasses, whatever. So there is always individuality, personality emerging, right? So for me, that is interesting, looking at those details, because those details humanize the person who is behind that countertop doing his hair, their work. And there is an element, even in homogeneity emerges individuality. And the other thing, very personal for me, not only when assisting to a mall, but in general in the everyday life, is shifting how I feel and what I think about wearing black. Every time I take a jacket or a black piece from my closet, I am not thinking about like how to perform elegance, modernity, wealth, because that element of fashion, fashion is also serves a lot for a performance of being rich, right? So for me, doing this article, writing those words, is a re-education of my own sensibility and like trying to shift or even hopefully decolonize the mind in regards how I imagine and who I imagine when I encounter a black piece, a black shirt, right? So for me, it's not just remembering Coco Chanel and her use of black as a dominant color, but instead of that, remembering migrants, workers, Latinx, Latin American individuals working hard in the US.
The politics of wearing black at first glance can be subtle and discreet. But if we were to look at it through the eyes of a fantastic guest like Edward Salazar, not only can it be eye-opening, but enlightening as well, which is why we're going to create a link to his article on our Twitter account. And so with that said, we've been speaking with Edward Salazar Celis. He's a writer, cultural critic, and educator specializing in Latinx American arts, fashion, and visual cultures. His recent article in Harvard's Revista is entitled Black is a Working Class Color, the Latinx Politics of Wearing Black. And so again, we're going to create a link to his article on our Twitter account. But in the meantime, Edward Celis, thank you very much for being on the show with us.
Thank you, Oscar. It's been a pleasure.
Absolutely. You got it. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
Commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the end of the U.S. war in Vietnam, Busboys and Poets, along with the Institute for Policy Studies, will host Vietnamese poet and novelist Nguyen Phan Ke Mai in conversation with Vietnam veteran Wayne Carlin in a program moderated by E. Ethelbert Miller on Thursday, April 24th from 6 to 8 p.m. At the event, 50 years after the end of the Vietnam War, A Pathway Toward Healing and Reconciliation, Ke Mai will read from her new book of poems, The Color of Peace, and Wayne will read from his latest book, Memorial Days, Vietnam Stories, 1973 to 2022. That's 50 years after the end of the Vietnam War, A Pathway Toward Healing and Reconciliation, Thursday, April 24th, 6 to 8 p.m. at the Tacoma Busboys and Poets. More information and how to RSVP can be found online, ips-dc.org/events. WPFW is your station for jazz and justice, building a better world one broadcast at a time.
WPFW presents Still We Rise, our 48th anniversary celebration, on Friday, April 25th, from 7 until 11 p.m. at Martin's Crosswinds in Greenbelt, Maryland. Entertainment will be provided by vocalist Navasha Dea and her trio, and WPFW programmers and poets Esther Iverum and Zain El Amin. The evening includes an award ceremony, dinner, and dancing to the music of DJ James Funk. That's Still We Rise, WPFW's 48th anniversary celebration. Details at WPFWFM.org.